Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking, how do you talk about music? Yeah, we all know what Elvis Costello said about music criticism. Writing about music, he said, is like dancing about architecture. Pithy stuff from a master lyricist, of course, and you'd expect no less. But what about taking songs to bits, looking at their inner workings, and sure, trying to frame those melodies and words in dastardly old words themselves? I've been writing about music, amongst lots of other things, for ages, and I'm always intrigued as to how others go about the job, especially the practical stuff, like how many times you have to listen to a record before you form an opinion you'd be willing to share with readers paying for your judgment. Well, the music writer Laura Snapes of Guardian and Pitchfork fame will be with us later to tell us what she thinks before she sharpens her pencil. But before that, we'll meet the musical mind behind one of the most popular podcasts in the musical sphere, Hrishikesh Hirway, founder and host of Song Exploder, who gets the songwriters themselves to tell the story behind the song. Your curiosity will be satisfied like a mighty thirst being slaked by a jug of the finest tart lemonade on a summer's day, but in a musical way. Now, as I mentioned, if you're a keen podcast listener, then you'll be more than likely to be au fait with Song Exploder. The idea is that each week a band or artist talks you through how they wrote a particular song. This might spark stories of serendipity or might take you page by page through the rulebook of songwriting itself. Either way, it's a fascinating insight into how you write a hit. The podcast was dreamed up by the LA-based musician and music lover Hrishikesh Hirway and is about to celebrate its 100th episode. Hirway tells me the story of how Song Exploder came to be.
Welcome to the first episode of Song Exploder. My name is Hrishikesh Hirway. On this podcast, in each episode, a musician plays one song of theirs and then breaks the recording down into pieces to give you an inside look into their creative and technical process. I wasn't originally thinking of it as a podcast at all. I was kind of a casual podcast listener at that point, and I was thinking, you know, I thought it would be an audio program, but I wasn't really thinking of it as an independent podcast so much. And it was March of 2013 when I actually sat down and started making the pilot episode with the Postal Service. But then it would take another 9 months before I actually put that episode out.
So why the delay? Was that in order to kind of fine-tune the answers that you got, the questions you asked? Did you have to go back to the band? Or was it simply getting it, uploading it somewhere that counted?
It was partly figuring out what the show actually would be, what the sound of it would be, and just polishing it, just having never made anything like that. I'd only ever made music, so I hadn't really done any kind of narrative thing before. And also, it was partly just trying to find the best way to put it out. I did think of it sort of like my band, in that you can put out a record. The media is democratized in a way where you can do so much of anything you want on your own. But it was important to me to try and have it come out with a splash, so that it wasn't just a piece of information floating out there that I was hoping, you know, somebody might listen to, but not really sure if anybody would. So I was trying to find a way to put it out that would have some impact.
German label More Music was another big influence on this song, and especially the second half of the song when the kind of four on the floor beat kicks in. I think I was trying to copy Lalipuna. So it's like the first half of the song is Bjork and the second half is Lalipuna.
You might know this as a musician yourself as well, that so many people, when they do their first thing, they put everything plus the kitchen sink into it. You stuck very precisely to this exceptionally tight format, one song, one artist talking about it, or the members of a band or group talking about their work. You've never done Album Exploder. You've never messed with that over 100 episodes. Was that very important to you to nail that precise formula for the show, Hrishikesh?
One thing is that the show is quite inconsistent in terms of what's actually being discussed. The genres change, the kinds of musicians, how old the songs are. Sometimes they're brand new. Sometimes they're 10 years old, the songs that are being discussed. So I would have the freedom to be able to do all those things if I kept the container for that discussion the same from week to week.
One thing I love about the program is the texture that you give it. I was just listening to the one that you did with Solange Knowles, where she talks about cranes in the sky.
I played a lot of piano on this album. I still just laugh that I'm doing it. That is so funny. I have not soloed these. For so long, I sang piano parts that I heard in my head to pianists. But sometimes rhythmically, it wasn't exactly how I heard it in my head. And so on this album, I was just like, I'm just gonna give it a shot.
She speaks so wonderfully. You get a sense of the texture of her voice, the idea. You feel very intimate with her and the studio. She speaks very close to the mic, as do most of your guests. Is that something that you encourage them to do? Do they feel differently talking to you and taking part in Song Exploder than they do talking on national radio or more international feeling something? How do you get that feeling of intimacy, I wonder?
Thanks so much. That's a great question. I think part of it is sort of artificially created in the editing. During the recording, I absolutely do try and get them close to the mic. And one thing I'd learned when I first started trying to do interviews and was trying to read up and take, you know, go to panel discussions with people who conducted interviews, one thing I had learned was that you can kind of set the tone for an interview a little bit by modeling the tone you want for your guest. So I kind of try and present it in a way that's a little bit more intimate and hope that they'll match my speed. But that's only, you can only do that so much. Really, I think it comes from the fact that I'm not in the episode. Because you don't hear my questions in the interview, you only hear their answers and you only hear the isolated parts of the music. I hope it feels almost like confessional, like the artist is speaking directly to the listener as opposed to speaking to me and the listener is getting to be a bystander. I was hoping that it would feel more like it was being spoken directly to them. There's no reason why somebody would want to tune into a podcast and listen to my perspective, whereas they might be interested in the artist's perspective. And so I thought, okay, well, my strengths are more in editing and mixing and making the audio. So let me focus on that part. And I thought if I could do my job well enough as an interviewer for these very specific kind of questions, then I could draw the information out and you wouldn't necessarily need to hear my side of it because I was kind of like, who am I? I'm just some guy. So it would be a more pure listening experience if I wasn't in it.
Do you think that's what makes your show different from a regular radio show, something that might sit in a radio schedule? It feels very much like kind of an ultimate podcast in that sense, that people come and listen to this show for the format. I can have Catholic tastes and listen to a show about Metallica and Carly Rae Jepsen one after the other and enjoy them equally when neither of them are perhaps my favourite artist. There is something bulletproof about the format, perhaps, that means that anyone can fit in and any listener can find great joy and pleasure in that. So they're not coming to you as a personality. They're damn well coming to your program, Hrishikesh. Is that something that you've tried to do to sort of spread the genres very evenly? Or maybe they're just the bands that you like?
I definitely was making a conscious choice to spread the genres around on the show because I wanted to demonstrate that the work that goes into making a song, all the little ideas, I think, you know, typically in interviews with musicians, you get a lot of talk about sort of the larger ideas, the big concepts behind an album or the lofty ideals that went into a song or a title or something like that.
You can never hear those influences perhaps on the record when someone says, oh, well, you know, I'm making it. It's a heavy metal album, but actually it's all about Bruegel. Exactly. You can't really hear that. Whereas if someone breaks down the songs in terms of the bar, the structure, the instrumentation, the sandwich they had that morning for breakfast, you can hear this in your show that you can't in the wider spectrum maybe.
Yeah, or even if they do have that big idea, if there's something in the song that they can point to that I can say, you know, here's my nod to the old masters is in the drum programming because there's a level of precision that, you know, or chiaroscuro in the whatever they want to say in the about the sound that they can connect that big idea to something you actually can hear. I think that's the difference. But I also wanted to show that so much of making a song is actual work where you have to figure a thing out or you have it's actually a collection of little ideas that you have and then you execute and you put into motion and it's really knitting all of those little ideas together. That's how a song gets made. And I wanted to show that that exists, whether it is Metallica or Carly Rae Jepsen or you're the composer for Downton Abbey. There are similar challenges, but what's interesting is how unique the results end up being because even when you have that formula of trying to take an idea and execute it, the results can be so wildly different.
And that kind of goes back to the idea of intimacy as well. Does the show work, do you think, because you're a musician talking to musicians rather than a music journalist talking to musicians? I noticed that musicians, when they talk to each other, when they hang out, they chat to each other and they sound each other out. They sound each other's influences out. but in a very different way to maybe how I would ask these questions of people. Is there a bit of a fraternity feeling or a sorority feeling about the world of musicians that enables them to kind of have more open ears when they're talking to their kindred spirits?
I think definitely. And that's a big part of what fueled the show to begin with. These are conversations that I was having with my friends. Anyway, Jimmy from the Postal Service is someone who I had toured with a lot. And I've talked to him a lot about his production. He's someone who's a friend, but also a big influence on me as well. And so being able to just ask him how he created some of the things that I would hear was always a great privilege for me. And anytime you're playing shows or you're visiting someone's studio, you get to have a little masterclass with them. And those conversations have been so fascinating for me, between those kinds of conversations and then also the actual things you get to hear when you get to listen to a song in its deconstructed form. Those were things that I thought people who aren't in that room would still definitely appreciate. So it came out of that idea of this is the kind of conversations that musicians have with each other. I just thought that people who aren't musicians would find something to appreciate as well.
Do you find that there is as much accident or design in the making of these great pieces of music?
Accident is something that you can't rule out, and a lot of great things come from it. But there have definitely been episodes where the song has been carefully designed from start to finish. And that's, again, I hope that the show demonstrates that there isn't really one right approach for making a song, which is something that's sort of a lesson that I think has been important for me to learn, both in terms of being a musician and just in general. Sometimes I forget that there isn't the right way to do things. When there are things that you admire that are really polished and well made, I think it's easy to get into your head and say, well, I can't do something like that because these people have either certain abilities or certain access to things that allow them to do things the right way or the proper way. And that's something I can't get to. Doing the show has been nice to sort of remind myself that that's actually very rarely the case. And a lot of times things happen accidentally or they just are made with whatever resources are there at hand.
I love that challenge of trying to think of a melody.
The second I heard you sing the chorus, the I Can Only Stare.
I can only stare, I can only stare.
When you hit the A, when she hits that vowel, it's like at the top of her range. And with that lyric and with the melody and the delivery, immediately it was like one of my favorite things that we had ever done. We worked on this track for a long time.
The first few demo versions didn't have verses.
And one thing this show has told us over 100 episodes, Rishikesh, is the bloody hard work, presumably, that goes into this. That there are moments of inspiration, there are moments of inspired instrumentation, all the rest of it. And overhearing something on the bus on the way to work will make people lay down the most phenomenal bass riff. But at the end of the day, these people are up all night trying to perfect this stuff. There's a lot of that in it. There's a lot of blood and sweat and tears as much as inspiration, right?
Definitely. I put out an episode just recently with Sleigh Bells of this kind of like perfect pop confection that they made. But in the course of the interview, they revealed that it took them 3 years. They had the chorus fully completed, but it took them 3 years to figure out how to get from that to verses and an arrangement that was actually a fleshed out song.
That was Rishikesh Hirway, creator and presenter of Song Exploder. The 100th episode will be released on Tuesday, the 21st of March. And who's landed the coveted anniversary episode? It's the American alt-rock favourites Dirty Projectors. Get your subscription now. Now, while the podcast has become a fairly new way of learning about music, fans have always relied on the views of music reviewers, whether in papers, magazines or online. A good critic will gain the trust of a listener and be able to guide them through what they may or may not like, week by week. It's not an easy skill to master. How do you put into words what music does or should or shouldn't do in an eloquent, accessible and not overbearing manner? Laura Snapes is a regular voice on Monocle 24 when we talk about music. She's also critiqued stuff for many esteemed titles such as Pitchfork, The Guardian, Uncut and plenty more besides. And she tells me her process of writing a review. Laura, thank you very much for joining us. We just heard from Hrishikesh there, who makes Song Exploder, a podcast that in the interim you told us that you're a fan of, in fact. So this is handy. And you heard how with musicians like Solange, for example, she will tell him how she's imbued a certain song with, well, she was talking about Cranes in the Sky, how she's imbued that song with meaning and with colour and all the rest of it. But you're working from a little bit more of a blank canvas. So how do you imbue a song with meaning, your own meaning, probably, to your readers?
Well, I think there's an interesting divide between intent and interpretation. So I really like the way that Solange, and I remember the Song Exploder episode with Mitski, where she talks about this as well, where they talk about the very literal emotions that are encoded in certain parts of the music. And it's really exciting to hear that artists think about the music in that way, which is obviously kind of an obvious thing to say. But as a reviewer, you don't necessarily have to take their intention and run with it. Your interpretation of the song is just as valid, as long as you're not being ludicrous about it. It is just as valid as what they're intending by it. And so for me, when I'm writing about a song, I think the important thing is, obviously on the internet now, people can listen to it, they can read the lyrics, they can read interviews about the song. And so it's important for me when writing about it to bring all these things together and try and synthesize some new ideas that readers might not have come to by themselves.
Okay, so that's an interesting thing. So as we know, you review for The Guardian, for Uncut, for pieces of paper, as much as you do for online, for websites and online music brands. Now, that's an interesting thing. I was talking about this with Holly before, actually, about, well, what happens when you can embed a song in a review? That's kind of cheating, isn't it? Or actually, maybe it's cheating you as a reviewer out of your colour and your ability to paint a picture with words, maybe.
I can see that argument, but personally, I don't think so. I don't really let that affect the way that I write. I mean, usually online, you get the opportunity to write more about a song than you would in a magazine. I think there are very few magazines that would let you write about a single song.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's a great help to have it there because it means that you don't have to explain everything that's going on. But I think, yeah, that idea of synthesis between what certain sounds are doing and how they correspond with the words and how they might link up to wider context in music or wider ideas that you have about the song, I think it's pulling threads between all of those things that makes a piece of writing about a song really interesting.
Yeah, I suppose there is that kind of further reading element that you can do in pure audio when you're writing for a website, I suppose, right? You can go, it sounds a bit like this, it might remind you of this, and this is what I was talking about here, and you can enrich the reader, I suppose, with that other reference.
Yeah, hyperlinks are definitely, I think, a really good tool. For example, Lorde released her comeback single the other day. It's called Green Light. It's a big kind of housey piano pop banger. The obvious interpretation that a lot of people came to is that Green Light is the same as the green light in The Great Gatsby, which is the end of the book where the green light signifies for Gatsby longing, which has kind of not really come to fruition because, spoiler alert, he's dead because of that longing.
You've gone and ruined it again, Laura Snapes.
But Lorde is a very, very well-read young woman, and I'm sure that she has read The Great Gatsby, but something about that's told me that it was probably a bit too basic for her to be thinking about that. And so I kind of Googled around and tried to see if Lorde had ever talked about the role of colour in her work. And it turns out that she experiences music through synesthesia, so music to her has different colours. And there was a great quote on her Tumblr about how once when she was writing an older song, when she first started writing it, it was this horrible tan colour that made her feel really, really sick. But then they did something different to the chorus or the bridge and it exploded in a riot of greens. And to her, that was really good. So it was like, okay, so green for Lorde obviously equals transcendent, so there's something here. And then instead of The Great Gatsby, it made me think about the novel Bluets by the writer Maggie Nelson. I don't know if it's a novel, but the memoir, where she spends a whole book meditating on blue and what it means to her and all the emotions she has bound up in it. And at the end of that book, she talks about how she wanted to be a student, not of longing, but of light. And I know, I thought Gatsby is like the longing thing, but the way that Lorde is singing about green light on this song, she wants to be a student of light, which might be a bit roundabout and flowery.
But that's what we want. I'm heartened to think that there is this much thought and effort and background reading and fandom linked cleverly together, frankly, that goes into a review, because a lot of people go, oh, knock it out. You know, it's 100 quid in this, I'll knock this out before lunch. And I think many listeners will be heartened that all these thought processes are going into your 550 word review of a song, an album. It's good stuff. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty then, Laura, of doing this thing. Do you have to be in a state of mind to review a record or give it its first couple of spins? Because busy days can affect a more subtle record, can't they? You know, they might not stand out against the crowd, against the bus, against the tube, against all the stuff we struggle with in city life. How many times do you give an album a fair hearing for, I wonder?
It depends on the length of the review. If I'm just writing a 100-word review, for example, for Uncut, which is the only place that I really do them of that length, you might just listen to something 3 or 4 times. Yeah. But if, for example, I'm doing it for somewhere like Pitchfork or for NPR, you're probably looking at least 600 words, maybe 1,000 words, maybe even a bit more. And so for that, I always try and make sure that I've listened to the record in a variety of situations for several weeks before I have to actually write something about it. If I really love the album and I'm a big fan of it, I might have listened to it 60 times by the time it comes out. There's an album which is being announced next week, hasn't even been announced yet, and I've already listened to it 60 times because it's so good. Not everything I'll listen to that much, but I like to make sure that I've listened in a variety of situations. So in the background while I'm doing some work or tidying up or something like that, maybe while I'm cooking, maybe in the car driving somewhere, maybe on the tube, just so you get a feel for what pops out to you in different situations. Something that occurs to you while you're listening to it in your room might be very different to what speaks to you while you're on the bus, for example. So I think that's really important. And then once I've had all those ambient listens and I feel really familiar with the different contours of a record, then I sit down and I think I have a really long-winded process, and I would love to hear other people's.
I love you talking us through this. This is exactly what we wanted. This is perfect.
Then I do what I would refer to as an annotated listen. So I will play the record through and I'll play and pause it a lot of times, and I will write real-time notes about what I think, what occurs to me while I'm listening to this music. And some of it will be really, really boring narrative. It will say the bass is doing this ticky part and then suddenly the synths explode, and there'll be loads of really, really shoddy metaphors in there and images, just like the first thing that comes to mind.
Just
to get it down there. So it's almost like I've drawn a map of the record for myself. And then if the album has lyrics, I will take the lyrics and I will go through and annotate them more heavily and try, I mean, if it is a lyrical band, not if it's just, you know, like an ooh baby kind of pop
record.
And then I'll try and
establish. You're in Pete and Dud territory there, aren't you?
Yeah.
He's grooving the bag, ladies and gentlemen.
And then I'll, once I've got the themes, I'll try and like establish a narrative and like group the songs that I might want to write about together in a paragraph, because I find an album review is really boring where it just kind of goes through song by song. You want to tell the listener, tell the reader a story that might not have occurred to them just through listening to it and enrich their experience of an album. So once I've got my lyric notes and my music notes, that's when I sit with another sheaf of paper and I try and kind of connect them and draw a rough outline of what the review is going to be like. That's for an album. For a song, it's a bit shorter. 'Cause after the after party, we're gonna stay till morning. And then when the time is up, we do it all again. I think you always have to think about the context that the music has been made for.
Yeah.
You know, I remember reviewing a single by a pop star called Charlie XCX. It's called After the After Party, and it's really abrasive.
Mm.
And it's not the kind of thing that you would perhaps necessarily want to listen to while you're like tidying up or doing some washing or something like that. But that's she hasn't made it for you to.
I think that's the review right there. This is not to do the washing for. That's the 5-star review right there, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because that's the thing. You can't criticize something for not fitting in a situation that it was never intended to. You know, that song is made for the club, or it's made for getting really drunk before you go out. It's made for like a communal exuberant thing, and to come at it with kind of like a sourpuss mentality, I think just says more about you than about what you're trying to write about. When you're reviewing like a Katy Perry record or something, you're not analysing it for this, you're not holding her to the same lyrical kind of standards as you might hold like a Bob Dylan record or something. It's clearly very different. So there's not a one-size-fits-all mode of criticism. You have to think about, you can only judge people for, this is something important I learned like in my early 20s, it's bad criticism to criticise somebody for what they aren't. You should only criticise them for how good they are at being what they're intending to be.
There we are. That's kind of like, that should be on your crest or something, shouldn't it?
Maybe, yeah.
Coat of arms. Now, without getting personal, we all do this as writers. You're kind of like scratching your head, and maybe these are the notes in the margin that don't make it into the reviews or wherever your reviews end up, Laura. Have you ever noticed yourself falling back on a stock phrase, on a kind of, oh, this is, you know, there's a certain adjective that seems to be the flavour of the month sometimes that you keep on writing into every little review for online, for the magazine, for la 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 la. What happens when that happens? Do you have to rip the whole thing up and start again? Or do you just think, I'm not going to listen to this record for 2 days despite the deadline? Or what happens when that happens? If that does happen to a writer of your esteem.
While I'm writing notes, there are definitely stock adjectives that come out, which I really try not to translate into the finished copy, because they're kind of more, when I'm going through my notes, I know what I'm, when I've written percolating in my notes, I know what I mean, but I know that I need to explain it in a more colourful way when it comes to the actual review. I really hope nobody's doing this. I can't imagine they are. If somebody paid close analysis to my work, they could probably find certain phrases that reoccur, because I think every writer does that. But
you're not going to offer any up for our listeners this afternoon.
This might sound awfully self-aggrandizing, but I just can't think of any.
No,
I do try really, really hard not to repeat myself.
Yeah, I went through a phase where I think I
interviewed John Cale, and I described one of his records to him. I said, I love it. It's got a kind of really gauzy quality. And he was like, gauzy? No, that's a great word. And I was so chuffed that John Cale liked my sort of oral review of his record that I kept on using it as far as the eyes I could see. The next year, everything was gauzy. So it is possible to get into these traps, I suppose, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A gauzy trap.
I try and like nuke them at the early level before anybody sees it.
Very wise, Snapes. Very wise. We started off this show talking to Hrishikesh Hirway, the founder of Song Exploder. Now, does having that extra level of knowledge, his podcast, his show, does a different thing to a regular record review, which is why it's really nice to have you here, Laura, to see how those two different worlds work. But they often do collide, and you obviously review with a lot of knowledge and background reading and all the rest of it, and no little passion. What happens when you know too much? Can you know too much to actually review something for the punter, for the guy that's going to just download it or is going to go and buy this record?
Yeah, you can definitely get too far into it. I remember towards the end of 2015, I was reviewing what is still the most recent record by Joanna Newsom, which is called Divers, which is very lyrical and she uses a lot of big words and she's highly intelligent and she brings in a lot of really, really deep concepts. And at one point, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning and I was trying to understand the Wikipedia page for string theory. Physics was like my worst subject at school. And I just thought, I'm too far down the rabbit hole and I don't know how to explain this anymore. That's the most painful review I've ever written. Like, tears were shed over that review. But trying to pull back from that and think, how deep is the average person actually going to go into this? You know, you can tell people things that they might not have thought about a record, but then you can just get too dense and too boring. You need to ultimately... Although I don't think reviews are really used to sell records anymore, I prefer to think of it as like cultural criticism rather than a commercial tool. Ultimately, you are trying to translate a product for people who might be interested in hearing it.
Yeah.
And I think you always need to rein in not going too wild with what you're doing.
And you can always go to Charlie XCX's After the After Party as a sort of antidote.
But there's a lot of interesting stuff encoded into that song as well.
Okay, all right. Well, my backstop is always, if in doubt, if you're thinking too hard about anything, just listen to In the Army Now by Status Quo. Then you're back to bass level. You're back to two chords and utter bass level understanding of human life.
Good tip.
No one take me up on that. Laura, it's always a pleasure having you in the studio. Thank you very much for dancing between the raindrops, between all the different types of reviewing records. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So how do you talk about music then? Well, if you're venturing an opinion, you probably love music, and that's the best first step. After that, with wide reading and with caution, Laura Snapes reminds us to understand why a song was written in the first place. Cheery chart toppers aren't supposed to be Bob Dylan, for goodness sake. Hrishikesh Hirway's wonderful Song Exploder shows us that the best reward is to go straight to the source. You'll find that artists as diverse as Solange and Metallica are assured amusing and endlessly enlightening when talking about how they do what they do. So how do you talk about music? With an open mind and a healthy sense of your own fallibility. Having said that, why not get angry about the things you love and hate? And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was the podcast exploder herself, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.